It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back with me tomorrow. Coming up in a few minutes, how interruptions affect the quality of work we do as students or on the job. First, there's been an ongoing concern that Wisconsin is experiencing a brain drain. The departure of young graduates has economic experts worried. They say these up-and-coming professionals are needed for job growth. They also provide a stable tax base and boost declining population in rural areas. Shemaine Mills reports.
As people age out of the workforce, state job growth will depend in part on young educated professionals staying in Wisconsin. Stevens Point native Brian Novotny has been at UW-Madison for 6 years in what he describes as an amazing city. But he wants to leave the state after he graduates, using his master's degree in kinesiology to coach sports or do physical therapy.
I don't like winter, so I'm hoping to move to California or North Carolina.
Angela Limbach is from Milwaukee with an undergrad degree in geology. She'll locate where there are suitable jobs, but as a climber, she'd like to be around mountains.
Nothing against Wisconsin. My family's here and I love it here, but going somewhere that fits my recreational interests would be better for me.
Earlier this year, the Governor's Conference on Economic Development discussed the brain drain. One of the featured speakers was UW-Madison's Morris Davis with the Wisconsin School of Business. He had crunched some numbers on age and job growth that he wanted to share.
Job growth is on everyone's mind, and I wanted to get a handle on what kind of job growth we could expect in Wisconsin.
Davis says between 2008 and 2012, on average, Wisconsin lost 14,000 college graduates a year. Most of those leaving were between the ages of 21 and 29. He says Wisconsin is still doing better than neighboring states, but
if you were to rank the states, we're second best relative to Minnesota, but it doesn't mean that we don't have a problem. It's just Illinois and Michigan's problems are worse than ours.
Once residents leave, it can be hard to get them back. Gail Hike is community development educator in Price County in northern Wisconsin. Price County actually grew during the 70s and 80s, but shrunk in 2000.
When the wood industry declined, I lost a lot of human capital to the Twin Cities. Young engineers, you know, folks who served on school boards, heads of civic groups. When the economy took a downturn, especially in the wood industry, a lot of them left our community and the state.
Price County is currently conducting a survey aimed at those between the ages of 29 and 39 to find out why they left and what would bring them back. On a bigger scale, the state's lead economic development agency, or WEDAC, along with the Wisconsin Alumni Association, is hoping to lure some Wisconsin natives back. Reed Hall is chief executive officer of WEDAC.
In fact, we just hosted a reception for Wisconsin graduates in Denver when we were out there for another conference. So these are small things that we're doing, and we'll be doing more of these to just remind people that Wisconsin is a great place to live and work.
The so-called brain drain isn't new to Wisconsin. Jeff Soxie is a labor economist with the Department of Workforce Development.
It's an issue that we've certainly been aware of within the department, and certainly, you know, others have been looking at this since the 1990s.
What's different now, he says, is quality of life issues are increasingly important for young professionals. Groups like Wisberg and the Rockefeller Foundation say access to public transportation is one thing that helps millennials decide where to live. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. Thanks to our technology, we've got a lot of ways to get interrupted while we're trying to get something done. The phone rings, the email pops up, the text comes in. We stop what we're doing. We check it out, maybe take the time to respond. But how much of a toll does that take on the work we do? There's a growing body of research on how interruptions are worse than we used to think, and our next guest is taking that research in a new direction. Cyrus Farugi joins us now. He's a doctoral student in human factors and applied cognition at George Mason University. Among other things, he studies the impact of interruptions at the Applied Performance Research Lab. Cyrus, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Before we get to your new findings, what has past research told us about interruptions' impact on time and errors when we're trying to do something?
So a majority of the research that exists look at time and errors when interrupted. And this makes sense. These are reasonable metrics. When you stop to complete an interruption or a secondary task, obviously the amount of time that you spend on your primary task will get increased. And these can be associated with costs. If you are a student and it takes you an additional 30 minutes or an hour to complete a project for a class, that probably doesn't really have any real impact, logistically. If you're a employee or you own your own business and it takes you an hour or two longer because of repeated interruptions, then that actually might cost you money. So you can actually put a denomination on what you might lose there. And then, so that's kind of how the time has been looked at. Mm-hmm. And then errors have been really, the error work really started out in laboratory research showing that when you're interrupted and you come back, when you're doing a procedural step-by-step task, a lot of times you skip a step or you make a mistake and, you know, return to the wrong point, things like that. But there's a lot of new research in the medical domain specifically that's looking at how interruptions are affecting nurses and doctors and potentially leading to a lot of, accidents, unfortunately.
And you took research in a new direction looking at how quality of work is affected. Why was that important to look into?
Just we figure that, you know, since time and error have been looked at so much, you know, a lot of times what's more important is how the final quality of your report or what you're working on comes out. As I said before, time may not be that, if you're a student, time may not be that big of a deal. If you turn in a paper and it takes you an hour longer because you're interrupted, that's fine. But if you got a C on that paper instead of an A, then your quality has changed. So that's kind of the approach we took with it, that there's just, it's important to know how the final quality of the piece of work you're doing comes out.
But the tricky thing there, it sounds like, is how do you measure quality? It seems like it can be more subjective than, you know, errors or time. Those are
right.
Easy to measure.
It's very subjective, especially compared to time and error, which are very, quantitative values in that regard. Fortunately, what we were able to do was the reason we chose writing, one, everybody, majority of people write daily, and it's a part of what we do. And then obviously the College Board, a lot of people take the SAT, and the College Board has a very nice rubric in place for grading essays. So there's millions of students have gone and taken the SAT, and they've wrote essays on it, and we basically mirrored that and used their pre-existing rubric as a basis for this study. So we had a nice way to actually measure using a nice structured rubric to measure a subjective piece of information.
So you sat people down, they're writing the SAT essay, and a key part here is they get interrupted. How do you scientifically interrupt them?
So what we did during the interruption condition was very simple. 3 1-minute interruptions, all they have to do is answer simple math problems. The reason math problems are chosen is because we actually don't want the interruption task to be so difficult that where they just stop and go and focus back on what they're doing. But at the same time, we don't want it to make it be too easy to where they can just do it automatically. So you kind of want something that's middle of the road that they can just process for about a minute. A minute is long enough to wipe pretty much everything in your short-term memory, assuming you're working on the secondary task. And math problems are pretty much a gold standard in this line of research anyway, so it made sense for us.
And that might be similar if you're working, typing away at work, and you get an email, and you've got to read it and respond to it. That might be a similar level of time and concentration.
Right. The whole key is just that you take your train of thought away from the primary task and focus on something else so that you're not rehearsing or thinking about the original project in mind. And that's in the real world when you get interrupted and go to do something else, that is what happens.
And what was the impact? Now, how much difference did these interruptions make on the outcome, the quality of their writing?
So on the 6-point scale that's developed by College Board, we saw an average drop of just over a half-point scale, which obviously was significant and a pretty big jump. So most people went from about 3.75 on average to just above a 3, and they said they pretty much got worse. I think 96% of participants got worse. A few people were able to stay at the same. No one got better during an interruption condition, which was important, but it looks like overwhelming majority of individuals were negatively affected.
So it only could make you worse. If you're lucky, you break even. No one got better with the interruptions.
More or less. I mean, maybe some people are more resilient, but for the, it could have just been noise, so to speak.
We're talking to Cyrus Farugi of George Mason University. He's talking about interruptions, how they affect the quality of the work we do at school and on the job. We'll get into some more of his research, other research out there, and what this might mean for how we behave at work, how we behave when we're writing that term paper for school. And you can join the conversation. Do you get a steady stream of interruptions at your workplace? How does it affect the quality and maybe the quantity of the work that you do? Do you have a strategy to avoid interruptions when you're doing a big project for school or work? Or do you let the phone ring, the email ding, and let the chips fall where they may? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post over at the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with Cyrus Farugi. He's a researcher at George Mason University, talking about interruptions and how they affect the quality of our work. His research shows it makes a significant difference. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have to deal with interruption after interruption on the job? Emails you got to look at, phone calls you have to answer, chatty coworkers you can't slam the door on? How does that affect your work? How do you deal with it? Call 800-642-1234 or post over at the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller now. We've got Joan on the line in Eastern Iowa. Joan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
What do you think? Do you get interrupted a lot? Did I just interrupt you?
No, I'm off duty for the day. No, I do get interrupted at work throughout the day, you know, both by the people that I serve and by fellow workers, whether they work for me and they need direction or they're my peers. And you know, sometimes it's not, we shouldn't consider it an interruption, perhaps, you know, communication. But I do get interrupted quite a bit, yeah.
All right. And do you think it makes the outcome of the job you do worse?
I think that, you know, obviously, if it's communicating, that's part of what I do. So, you know, again, it's how we define it as an interruption. But sometimes it's just plain an interruption, and it does affect my productivity, I would say, negatively. It's, you know, sometimes it's hard to pick up a task right where you left it off. You got to kind of start over, you know, to do it right because you've been interrupted, and that's obviously affecting your time.
Joan, thanks a lot for that call and sharing your experience. And Cyrus, is that part of the deal? You mentioned the impact of dropping it and then having to take the time to pick it up being one factor in time and error. Do you think that's part of what disrupts the quality of the work we do, too, when we're interrupted?
So that's interesting. Yes, in one way. Restarting from the beginning of the task is basically a way to get your train of thought back on track. And we do see people doing that, but not everybody takes that strategy. Some people try and resume right at where they left off. So we have some follow-up research, at least in the quality area, that has suggested maybe two different things are going on, and this might be person-dependent. One is that there might be this triage effect where people kind of quit, when they come back from the interruption, they kind of just move on to the next major point or the next thing they want to focus on instead of finishing what they were working on before. Another idea, and this, like I said, might be just how people work on their projects, is some people kind of start from the beginning and they attempt to get, like, the global ideas going again, but it just doesn't seem to work as well. Their whole thinking kind of gets skewed, so to speak. The global processing can get disrupted. But we're still trying to figure that out, honestly.
When we're on the job or at school, do you think we're conscious of how much impact these interruptions have? I think I wasn't until I started thinking about it for this interview. I'll give myself as an example. Am I the norm?
I would say you're the norm. We're actually following, we're doing some research in how people perceive interruptions. We're doing some research on that as well. This has been looked at least in the multitasking world a little bit, and it definitely seems like from multitasking perception does not match performance. People might think that they're doing fine or they're doing well, but in reality, the data would suggest otherwise. We suspect this is the case with the interruptions as well, but we're trying to figure that out a little bit more right now as we speak. We have some projects looking into that right now.
Back to our callers now with Jim on the line in Madison. Jim, hi.
Hi.
Oh, what did you want to bring up, Jim?
Well, I'll tell you what. Yeah, I know this is a challenge for everyone that has a multitasker, whoever gets interruptions, but I read an article in a little blip in Bloomberg Business a couple of months ago about a computer programmer who was crunching some kind of neuroscience data, big data, and he found that he was in a certain zone, he could really be productive and everything was working, but these interruptions would affect that. He invented this headband And the headband did a couple things. It read his brainwaves, so it they learned, you know, with some of the neuroscientists he was crunching numbers for, they looked at his brainwaves and were able to see when he was in the zone, made a headband that would read those brainwaves, and then he designed it so that when he was in that zone, his phone, instead of ringing, would go right to voicemail, and he put cute little pink ears on the headband so that his coworkers would see when the ears were up. I'm receptive. Come and talk to me. If the ears are down, I'm in the zone. Leave me alone.
Jim, thank you so much. Wow, that's a really innovative way to do this. Well, Cyrus, we're not all neuroscientists. If we can't have that flow reading headband, are there things we can do with existing technology to try to deal with these interruptions and avoid them?
So first off, I want to say that's very interesting, and I'm going to look into that. So there are some things you can do. The obvious ones are just to reduce all the external interruptions that you can. You can silence your phone. You can disable your notifications and things like that. Now, in terms of technologies that are coming out, there are some individuals who are actually developing email filtering systems, for example, that have kind of a smart sensor and can read your calendar and can read other information you have set so that when you're in the middle of a meeting or you're doing something important, unless the email, for example, is flagged as very high priority, it's going to get stowed away until you're ready to, until you come out of that, until later. So there are some things that people are trying to develop to help deal with all the interruptions that occur daily.
Do we need to change our workplace expectations, acknowledge that, hey, maybe that email I sent you, it's okay that you didn't respond within 5-10 minutes because you had something you needed to get through?
Exactly, and I think that it comes down to the businesses. So a lot of companies expect for their employees to get back with each other immediately or to respond to customers immediately, and while that's very important, at the same time, I think in the long term, a company would also appreciate if the quality of the work that someone was doing was top-notch, equally as important.
Jim, thanks for the call. We'll go to David now in East Troy. David, hi.
Yeah, hi. I pretty much am constantly interrupted at work, and I found that working longer days, 4 days a week, 3 days a week, versus doing a typical 8-hour day helps me kind of get through and accomplish tasks and projects despite interruptions. I'm wondering if there's any basis to that.
Why do you think that is, before I toss it over to Cyrus?
I mean, for me, it's a matter of the hours I hold. I can get in early. I can get things accomplished without the interruption.
Ah.
But then also during the day when I am, dealing with those constant interruptions, it's something that, I've already got at least a start on or a head start on things, I guess. So, yeah.
David, thanks a lot for that call. So that his strategy is in part working a longer day, and he gets in early, so at least part of his work day is before the interruptions start coming in. I don't know if that's a strategy everyone could use, but Cyrus, does that make sense?
It makes complete sense. Anything you can do to, facilitate your production, one way being either staying late or coming in early when you're not going to be interrupted or distracted as much, would most likely increase your productivity. Unfortunately, it seems like the majority of his time during the day is still impacted. So.
All right, David, thanks a lot for the call. Good luck getting the work done. We've got Joan now in Williams Bay. Joan, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. I wonder if your guest has studied the effect of interruptions on children. And number two, children have been interrupted so many times before they get to school and work that you think that we could have learned to live with them.
Interesting, Joan. I think that might, Cyrus, I think that might be a bit beyond your research, but thoughts on kids' tasks and interruptions?
So research in children in this area in general, in a lot of areas, is actually very limited. And from what I know, there's no research with children and interruptions. But to the second point, I think she was alluding to the fact that younger individuals now kind of grow up with more technology, and they grow up with more multitasking and more interruptions. So I'm assuming that she means that since you grow up with all these things around you, you might adapt to them and be more comfortable and be able to handle them better. So at least some of the research from the multitasking literature would show that that's not really the case and it can have an opposite effect. A really good example is a study that looks at cell phone usage while driving. And that's multitasking, but it's also in some veins very interruptive. And it actually found that the younger individuals were their perception of driving ability while using a cell phone was considerably more skewed than older individuals who used technology less. So you know, you might think that since you're able to, since you grow up with it, you might be able to deal with it better. But there's really, at this point, there's no literature to suggest that's the case.
So the best strategy for now is to, when we've got that key thing going on, turn off the interruptions as much as we can.
Right.
All right. Cyrus, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Cyrus Farugi. He's a researcher at George Mason University, and we've been talking about his new study on the effects of interruptions, not just on the quantity of work we do and how much time it costs us, but on the quality of the finished product that we do while we're being interrupted repeatedly. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, our guest makes the case that the struggle against climate change has failed, but he says we still need to take action. First, two U.S. appeals court panels issued conflicting rulings on the federal subsidies portion of the Affordable Care Act today. At issue are the tax credits used to subsidize health care costs for those who live in states that didn't set up statewide exchanges. That group of states includes Wisconsin. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the 4th District in Richmond ruled the federal subsidies were legal. The court said IRS interpretation of the law was a permissible exercise of the agency's discretion. But a few hours earlier, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit ruled the government could not subsidize health care for those participating in the federal exchange as opposed to the state exchanges. Here to explain these rulings and what they could mean for the future of the Affordable Care Act, we have Kyle Chaney. He's a reporter for Politico. Kyle, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here.
Well, it was bad news, good news in that order from the perspective of the White House. What kind of reactions were we hearing as these rulings came down?
I think the reaction you heard from supporters of the health care law was very immediately was don't panic. This though the ruling from the D.C. Circuit, which, as you said, would basically end subsidies available to people who bought health insurance through the federal exchange, healthcare.gov. Again, that's 2/3 of the states. That would be, you know, catastrophic for the healthcare law and could lead to millions of people losing coverage. But again, there is a conflicting ruling, and it's going to wend its way through the courts for months, if not years, before there's actually a final determination.
Well, let's tackle each of today's rulings in turn. That one from the District of Columbia Circuit ruled, as we mentioned, against federal subsidies in states that didn't set up their own exchanges. What was the argument for overturning that part of the Affordable Care Act?
The argument there was that the law, essentially the intent there was that subsidies were only supposed to be available through exchanges built by states. The language of the law kind of says that plainly, but the argument against that has always been that the intent was always that every state would build its own exchange and that the federal government would step in where a state could not or would not, but that those would still be technically sort of run by the states. What the court said is no, the law kind of is not just ambiguous on that, it actually says something completely different. So we can't support this idea that the federal exchange should be doling out subsidies when the law doesn't actually give it the authority to do that. Though the law doesn't give the authority, the IRS actually issued a rule that allowed those subsidies to start flowing. So this ruling basically vacates what the IRS did.
But there wasn't any kind of injunction from that. It doesn't mean that things change right now. Is that right?
Exactly. So the status quo is still in effect and will be for some time. So that's why I think you're hearing from supporters of Obamacare say, hey, take a breath. Let's wait and see how this plays out. We think it's going to get overturned when this goes to the full D.C. Court of Appeals, not just this three-judge panel. And if not, you could actually even see this go back to the Supreme Court because you have conflicting rulings.
And that's not a gimme that it's necessarily going to go to that full court, right? The Obama administration is filing to get that to happen.
Right. They're convinced, I think, that they also have the makeup of the right judges on that court that would look favorably on their argument. But no, it's not a guarantee. And again, when you have conflicting rulings at the appeals level, those are usually ripe for what the Supreme Court takes a look at, too.
And over at this 4th District Court of Appeals in Richmond, they ruled, in effect, in favor of the Obama administration. What was the prevailing argument there?
Exactly. The argument there wasn't so much that the administration got it right, but that the law was so unclearly worded and ambiguous that they couldn't rule against the administration. It was that it seemed, you know, depending on how you parse it, that either argument could be right, and therefore the IRS was correct to, or could be correct in issuing subsidies the way that it did, and so therefore they couldn't strike it. So it wasn't quite a wholehearted endorsement of the administration's argument, but it definitely would preserve the subsidy situation as it is today.
This is a suit, or there have been a lot of suits, I should say, around the country from citizens, but backed by, in many cases, conservative think tanks or legal organizations. What were we hearing from them after, especially the District of Columbia ruling, striking it down?
Hearing mostly in the political realm, because I think even the conservatives who are happy with the ruling know that it's going to be several more shoes to drop before it's final. So what I think you're hearing now, especially from Republicans and conservatives, that hey, this is what we've been saying all along. This law was so poorly worded, this law was so badly crafted that the courts, not only are they conflicted, some of them even think that a big piece of the law needs to be overturned. But you know, this is a symptom of how rushed and poor, I guess, the process of crafting the law was.
Now, the rulings affect 36 states, including us here in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. If that ruling we were just talking about, the one striking down these subsidies, went through, what would that mean for how the Affordable Care Act works in Wisconsin and elsewhere?
It's funny because Wisconsin's almost in its own category, because Governor Walker's health reform plan relies on the federal exchange to when he transferred people off of Badger Care there. So in some ways, Wisconsin may see a disproportionate impact if that ruling were to be upheld. But in general, it just means that states could have thousands, tens of thousands of people who, all of a sudden, healthcare becomes unaffordable for them through the federal exchange, and would either have to get exemptions or find another way to get coverage, and that could be, from a policy point of view, from a well-being point of view, really a catastrophic situation.
Well, out there in the news lately, we saw the Supreme Court's become known as the Hobby Lobby ruling, allowing some companies to exempt themselves from covering contraception. It was a big deal, but it was kind of an around-the-edges sort of thing for the Affordable Care Act. This is much more at the core, isn't it?
This is at the heart. This is really, the Hobby Lobby situation is very controversial, and it attracts a lot of, again, political intrigue, and this religious conflict is important to a lot of people. But in terms of what the Affordable Care Act needs to function, the ability to offer subsidies through the exchanges is absolutely central to making this law work and extending coverage to as many people as were able to receive it. So the law would be completely almost dismantled in a way if this ruling were upheld.
This would mean that I've seen different numbers, including numbers like 5 million people would now not be able to afford this unsubsidized coverage, so they can't get the coverage, but they're required to get the coverage.
Although there is a mechanism that says if you can't afford the coverage, you're not required anymore, so you'd be exempt from any penalties, but then you're still left with lots of people without insurance, and that may be a bigger issue in some respects.
Do you get a sense from opponents of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, that they are hoping to destroy the whole thing in court, or are they doing it all fronts? They're hoping Republicans take control of the legislature, then the presidency, and do it that way instead.
Yeah, I think it's sort of an all hands on deck kind of thing. The courts was just one avenue where they've been hoping to chip away at it. I think when they lost in 2012 on the individual mandate argument, which is also a central component, I think the strategy shifted towards the politics. But the Hobby Lobby ruling and this ruling in particular sort of revived that hope, I think, that the courts could be a venue to really get at the law.
We've seen the Affordable Care Act in the Supreme Court a couple times now. If these conflicting appeals court rulings, and I think others coming down the line, go through to the Supreme Court, when would that be? When would they take it up?
It's unclear whether, I've talked to some colleagues who sort of track the workings of the court, and they seem to think that it could be conceivably the next term, so next year, but it may be an additional year, too. So we could be talking about a status quo situation for a couple of years. In a way that would potentially go past at least the midterm elections, but would definitely be a long-term situation.
Kyle, thanks so much for joining us today.
You got it.
That's Kyle Chaney. He's a reporter for Politico. Climate change has made a lot of news so far this year. In March, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, warned of the impact climate change can have on global food supply, human security, and the world's economies. In May, federal agencies released their biggest yet assessment of climate threats here in the U.S. Last month, the EPA imposed limits on greenhouse gases from existing power plants. Today, we hear the previous 2 months were both record breakers when it came to high global temperatures. Add it all up, our guest says, we are currently failing in the battle against climate change. With us now is Dale Jamieson. He is Director of Environmental Studies at New York University, formerly associated with the National Center for Atmospheric Research. His new book is Reason in a Dark Time, Why the Struggle Against Climate Change Failed and What It Means for Our Future. Dale, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
So past tense, you write, failed. It's already failed. Make the case that we are already on the downslope.
Well, we have already acted in such a way as to commit the planet to more than 1,000 years of warming. Our children, our grandchildren, and their grandchildren will live in a very different world than the one in which we grew up.
Why did we fail? What was it about our thoughts and our actions that led to this?
Well, the interesting thing about climate change is that I have a friend, an economist friend, who once said if you wanted to design a pill that would put an end to humanity, it would have many of the qualities of climate change. It's a problem that's long-term. It's a problem whose effects are very indirect, very dissociated from the causes. Evolution didn't build us to respond to the buildup of colorless, odorless gases in the atmosphere. It's a really difficult problem. And then you layer on top of that the dysfunctions of our political system, the problem in our short-term economic thinking, the fact that our ethical and moral systems are really about what one person does to another person at present tense. It's just not a problem that we're geared up to solve. And so we've got to learn how to solve these kinds of problems, because these are the kinds of problems that we're going to see more and more in population-dense, high-technology societies.
And this is, in many ways, as you say, an ethical problem. How do we recalibrate our ethics from worrying about direct harm I do someone to being a big part of a big complicated system of doing harm to people down the road?
Well, that's obviously a question for which there's no simple answer and no short-run answer. It's one that's going to require a kind of moral revolution in our thinking. But we're going to have to get our arms around this problem even before our moral systems and our economic systems are able to deal with them. We're going to have to look past some of these really almost insuperable difficulties and focus on things that are relatively simple in order to reduce the warming and to allow us to adapt.
And as you say, there's no one perfect solution. There's no superhero waiting in the wings to save us. Is that part of what's made it difficult for us to tackle this?
That's right. We keep waiting for the adult in the room to come and fix everything or make it better. We think that simply scapegoating one part of the world, China, or one part of society, corporations, that somehow that's going to, you know, let us go into an us versus them thing that's going to work. But it's not like that. It's that humanity as a collective is going to have to get off of fossil fuels and find another way of organizing the global economy.
And it's clear from what you're saying, although you write that our effort to prevent climate change has failed, that's not an excuse to give up now.
That's right. There's at least three reasons for that. The first is the degree of the warming matters. If we have a 2-degree warming, 3-degree warming, 4-degree warming, all of those little numbers represent vastly greater levels of destruction and much greater risks in terms of catastrophic climate change. Secondly, the rate of the warming matters. We're much better at adjusting to a relatively slow warming than a very rapid warming, although the warming we're experiencing is going to be rapid by any standards. But thirdly, climate change is also going to reshape the way that we live, the kinds of things we do in terms of outdoor activities, where we take our children, the kinds of stories that we tell. And we're going to have to find new ways of meaning and new ways of telling those stories. And so there's a lot for us to do to slow down the warming, to limit its extent, and to figure out how to live in this new world we're creating.
Are we starting to turn from prevention to adaptation to, as you say, figure out how we're going to live in this changed world?
We're starting that turn. we're turning more slowly than I wish we would. And the other concern that I have is that a turn towards adaptation can actually make us too focused on ourselves. I mean, I live in New York. I lived through Hurricane Sandy. There's a high level of consciousness here now about storm surges and about the new normal and the superstorms and so on. But what there isn't a lot of consciousness of is it's not just New Yorkers that are going to be experiencing these things, not just Americans, but people in Mumbai, people in Karachi, people in Alexandria, people all over the world, including people who have emitted much less carbon than Americans have.
And that's part of the problem. You say sometimes the biggest harm will be in the places where the biggest responsibility isn't. The people emitting aren't the ones who will suffer the most.
That's right. So we need not only to adapt, but we also need to adapt our sense of empathy. And when we experience these impacts of climate change, we also have to understand that others are experiencing them, who have less resources in many cases than we do and have done less to cause it. So there's no way of getting around the fact that we need a kind of globalization of consciousness that begins to match the kind of globalization of capital and of our economic system that we've seen develop over the last half century.
Where does that start? Where does that come from?
Well, it starts probably with taking responsibility for our own actions as individuals and recognizing that when we consume something, when we choose to drive instead of bike, for example, or walk, that we're really taking on this responsibility for where these fossil fuels come from, where they go, and so on. But it also, I think, involves changing the way that we think about our political choices and our choices as citizens as well.
You've also mentioned the role of the media in covering or maybe miscovering climate change. What do you think the media has done wrong? What would you like to see them, or I guess us, I'm part of it, do better?
Well, Rob, I'm holding you personally responsible for this, of course. No, I think there's two areas where the media have been quite unhelpful. One is in treating this as a kind of political story where it's one side against the other and one team has their facts and the other team has their facts. You know, the atmosphere is not a member of any political party. And no matter how much we talk about this, that, and the other thing, the greenhouse gases continue to reach the atmosphere and to change the climate. There's plenty of room to argue about what policy choices we should take in response to this problem. But there's really no reason to be arguing with the basic facts of the science. And the media too often has sort of treated this like a team sport. Here's the climate, people who believe in climate change, the people who don't believe in climate change. That's really not the way to talk about science. The second problem, I think, is that it's a very difficult issue. It's a very confusing issue. And climate is actually an aspect of every other issue. So my favorite example of misservice that the media often performs is from my local hometown newspaper, the New York Times, where you can read, on the front page of the newspaper, that climate change is a terrible problem, no one's doing anything about it, and then you can read in the business section about how the price of oil is skyrocketing and what a terrible thing this is. You've got to put those two things together. Climate change is related to our meat consumption, to our energy consumption, to all of these things, and we really can't just say, it's great when fossil fuels prices are cheap, but climate change is terrible. You've got to put those two thoughts together if you really want to educate your readers.
Do you see positive signs of change, whether at the policy level or at the people level?
Well, the biggest change is that from 1992 to 2009, all eyes of the world were on the global negotiations to try to bring climate change under control. Those negotiations essentially collapsed in 2009, though diplomats continued to fly around the world doing what diplomats do. And the action has really turned to towns, cities, regions, countries, and the national politics or the local politics in those places. And we're seeing a lot of action in the United States, in states and localities, but we're also seeing lots of action in other countries around the world as well. None of this action is enough. We're going to suffer. It's going to be a wild ride. But nevertheless, things are happening, and things are beginning to move. We still need national action. The Obama administration has done pretty much what it can in terms of executive orders, but we need national legislation. We need to put a price on carbon. There won't really be any substitute for that.
Are you optimistic that something like that could happen? I know you've been working on this book for about 25 years. Is that going to happen in the next 25 years?
Well, you know, think like an optimist, live like a pessimist. It can happen. Will it happen? I don't know. But I know that every day when I get up in the morning, something good can happen. Some of it is just simply reducing meat consumption. Some of it is knowing that decisions are being made to regulate coal-fired power plants, for example, that hadn't been done in the past. So there's plenty of good things that can be done and will be done every day. There's plenty of good projects for us all to work on as individuals and in communities. So that gives me optimism. And humanity, at the end of the day, what makes us special, if anything, is that we're an extremely adaptable species. And we will adapt. Life will go on. Much will be lost. People will suffer. But there are things we can do to make it better.
Dale, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob.
That was Dale Jamieson. He's professor of environmental studies and philosophy at New York University. His new book is Reason in a Dark Time, Why the Struggle Against Climate Change Failed and What It Means for Our Future.